He answered all your questions from the week before. You should listen to it. Is it still up?
It's still up.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll keep it up for a couple of days.
Do you have an extra copy of those connotations?
Yeah,
in detail.
Of course.
Yeah.
And I was reminded in how much detail.
It was good detail.
Good detail, okay. Didn't I send you one?
No. You sent me the quotes and the images, but not those. But that's okay. Okay.
I didn't send you the sheet with the quotes?
With the connotations. The eye and the, what those little short things mean.
Oh, yes, I do have those.
Oh, thanks. Thank you. No, you sent me everything.
Okay. I'll just give you the URL. You know, if you don't know it, put this audio up here.
Tammy, it's a secret place on his website, and he's putting the address up right now.
Okay.
The alchemical area.
I keep them up for 2 weeks, but I'll keep them up for a couple of days, and then I'll put them on. So they're MP3 files.
Oh, okay.
And it's forward slash, isn't it? It's forward slash, Gary.
But if you go to your home page and then you just wipe out the lap,
you can just go to the home page,
add on /audio, you'll get there.
Yeah. And there's no link to that from my home page, so I kind of want to just keep it for us.
Okay.
Well, you got a friend who wants to listen, that's fine, but just more or less. Because we say things, you know, people might think.
If we have a friend that wants to listen, it's okay.
Oh, it's fine, sure.
Yeah. I have a colleague that's totally isolated in Australia wanting to hear about Jung.
Oh, sure.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
She's living in 2 railroad cars.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
She's an artist.
Oh,
my God. Where is she in Australia?
I forget now.
Does she have a bathroom and a kitchen and everything?
I didn't want to be too nosy.
Yeah.
How do you guys?
Is she in the outside?
Partly because she's working with some Aboriginal people too, so she's very close, and they're coming. And her, the guy she's living with is a sculptor too, and a painter. And they have certain projects they're working on with the Aboriginal people.
Well, the Aborigines are so productive themselves.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Well, just a quick review. We are dealing with this distinction, spirit of the times, spirit of the depths. We talked about 2 main theological ideas of Jung. I am working with Edinger's labels for the general subject matter, epistemological criticism, and the paradoxical God image. Epistemological criticism is Jung's position that you can't know God, you can experience God, and that the way the experience of God seems to be happening when looked at through the point of view of what the dreams consider sacred is the fulfillment of meaning. And then we talked about how that sounds so nice, but really it involves error, destruction, confusion, etc. That's the paradoxical side of the God image. And what I tried to do was give you the conclusions that Jung reached from these ideas as prima materia. Thinking if we got some idea where he took these ideas down the road, it would be easier to understand them in their raw form. And these are very raw formulations, which he says he spent a lifetime polishing up, trying to give examples for, and so on. And I think that took us to 30.
Gary, I kind of had a question. Just something I was like, I don't know, maybe it's just playing around in my imagination, but it seemed to me almost as if he were saying that there's something behind God, and that's the supreme meaning, and that the God image then is an instrument of that.
I think he's saying the supreme meaning is God.
Is he?
Yeah.
Okay. And then the God image is an instrument of
God. Well, I should say that the God image and the supreme meaning are the same thing.
Okay. Okay. I was just playing around in my mind thinking, well, there's something behind the God image.
Well, that's an open question, of course. In other words, how can I put it? I wish I could find a letter that he wrote. Maybe someday I will. But he makes the point that I'm not saying God is only the God image. I don't know what God is. My statements aren't trying to define what God is or isn't. My statements are just trying to define what my experience is. Because people will say, oh, Jung, you're saying God is the God image. He makes it very clear, no, I'm not saying that. I don't know what's behind it. Since I don't know what's behind it, what's the point of talking about it? And people will say, well, then that's the object of belief. And he would say, I'm not interested in belief. I'm interested in experience. And that's, you know, that is his position. It is certainly contrary to much of contemporary theology. And he's certainly aware that it's at odds.
Because that's like Kant, that's saying the same thing.
Same thing that Kant's saying.
You can't know it.
Yeah.
Because it's infinite and we're
finite. And we're finite, yeah.
Okay.
Right.
And so that we can know part of it via experience, our experience.
Well, we don't even know if we can know part of it.
Oh, okay.
We don't know if what we know is part of it or is our fantasy of it.
Does fantasy equal experience?
Yeah, my experience could very well be simply a fantasy.
I'm a little confused because we talk about the God image, but it seems as though they're all multiple God images of different,
different religions, for example. Yeah,
religions,
yeah, most definitely.
Example.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
yeah.
That gets...
I think,
except when we say
yeah,
God is the God image.
You probably should say God is a bunch of God images.
A bunch of God images. Okay.
You know, and really, that is why he is saying it the way he's saying it, I think. To give validity to every image of God.
Okay. So when I look at it the other way, then I'm just as caught in that my God image is... God image.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there are bunches of God.
Yeah. And this is a whole other question, but...
Or my experience.
It's
not just
right.
The experience.
Very important. I think there's a very important implication. See, because I have this theology degree, I'm always talking to these theologians in my head. And what people have said to Jung is, Jung, your religion is solipsistic.
So what?
Solipsistic. Might as well put that up there.
Yeah, he's self-centered, closed, self-system. Is that right?
I think so.
Closed in on itself, like... catatonia is solipsistic. Or you might
narcissist or solipsistic.
Yeah.
It just wrapped up. And they're saying, Jung, your theology is solipsistic because it's only about your image. Real religion is a communal experience, and you admit, and you omit that. That's the criticism. His response is, at the moment, there is no longer any valid collective religious imagery. The best we have at the moment is individual experience. And that's why he feels inner work is so important, that each of us bring up our own image of God. In time, I believe, he feels, that will merge into a new manifestation of an experience of God which can be shared. So the solipsistic bit is a phase in the birth of a new, more general image of God. And I think, personally I think, it will have features of Hinduism, of Buddhism, of Christianity, of Judaism, of the goddess. I told you about the conductor in Greece in our theology talk. I'll tell you about that story. I was on a train going to Mycenae, you know, the citadel where the Mycenaeans worshipped a female divinity. I was on the train in a non-smoking car, I have to embellish it a little bit, and with a bunch of Greeks, and we started talking, and they all pulled out cigarettes, and we are sitting there smoking. I don't smoke, but when in Rome, you know. And the conductor came by, he bummed a cigarette, you know. So he sat down, all of us were smoking in the non-smoking car with the conductor. And the conductor said to me, what are you going to Mycenae for? And I said, well, I'm interested in theology and psychology, and I have the feeling that we're in a period of religious transition, and that the new understanding of God is going to be a mixture of the masculine and the feminine. I'm curious how these feminine deities are personified. He says, oh, yes, he said, I've thought that for a long time. So maybe there is some truth to that, that even at the grassroots level, there's a sense that we're in a period of transition. The new God image will be masculine, feminine, multicultural, and the synthesis of those people courageous enough to go into their psyche and bring up, articulate, and this is why I think art and writing is so important, their sacred experience. So that, I mean, your questions really touched on a deep underground supposition of Jung.
I have one question.
Yeah.
Going back a little bit. You said that experience could be only fantasy.
Yeah.
Well, how do we know it?
Well, we don't.
Fantasy is.
We don't.
So we don't know whether we're having a fantasy or experience?
Of God.
Of God.
Yeah. See, with people to people, you can query others, you know. I think so-and-so is such-and-such. And everyone says, I agree. Probably it's not a fantasy, or else you're all having the same fantasy, which is probably unlikely. Or somebody can say, no, Karen, so-and-so isn't such-and-such. Then you know it's a fantasy. And I would say, actually, science is an attempt to distinguish between perception and fantasy by the method of repeatability. If the thing can be repeated, it's more likely a fact. But, you know, if you talk to a genuine scientist, they will say, science can't prove it's true. It can only prove it's false. But I think this is the challenge of our time, to realize how subjective our experience is and stop dumping it on other people. This, I think, is the political, if you will, or practical social consequence of what we're talking about here, which started in these visions.
Well, I think it's very interesting, this thing about community, because that's a big push in Christian church.
Right.
The last 25 years or so. And as you say, he says, it has to be individual.
Right.
But everybody has to be individual.
Right.
So it's sort of a creative community.
I think at the time, it's hard to say. Practically speaking, I'm not quarreling with the church's emphasis on community. But as far as, you know, deep theological revelation, it could very well just be a substitute. Let's go to community as community, when in fact, when religion was alive, you didn't go to community, you went to God. And God brought you together. But that little God bit is missing. So let's all nice be, you know, caring, giving Christians. And I don't think it works.
After
the first class, I did go home and ask my daughter Sadie what God's purpose is.
Yeah.
And first she looked at me in shock, and then she looked at me like, you know, very sad that I even had to ask her, and she went, "Mom, we need God because we need something to calm us down." And that's all she would say.
Wow.
And I said, "Well, can you explain that?" And she said, "I just think you have more to learn." That's all she would say. She said, "I can't explain it more than that. You just have to figure that part out."
Wow.
So if any of you figure that out, let me know, because I'm still puzzling that one. I said, "I don't feel like God always calms us down." And she said, "Then you're just not listening the right way."
Wow. Well, keep that open, because we might be able to interpret that as we go along and see the truth to it. I think there is a truth to it.
Mm-hmm. I have one more question. When you're talking about the spirit of the times and the spirit of the depth,
right,
are those always in opposition, and is the spirit of the times always changing to move forward? It's always in a negative light.
Right.
There are positive sides of it.
Right. You know, I don't think we really know. In Jung's time, it was so clear that this war, he had dreams of this war while everybody was partying. I think that's not to forget the cultural context of these visions. The question is, what is the difference today? And I'm not sure I know. It would be nice to say, given the existence of psychology, given the existence of, you know, more cross-cultural awareness, that our spirit of the depths and our spirit of the times isn't so far apart. If I had to, you know, absolutely say on the pain of death what I think the spirit of the times, of the depths might be, it's involved with the collision with Islam. If you remember the dream that Jung interpreted in the dream analysis seminar, those of you who did that, a cross and a crescent were put together in a vessel and a new light came out of it. And that was 1910. So I wonder if it's something like that. In other words, we treat our conflict with them, you know, politically, we talk about it economically, but nobody talks about it archetypally. And the fact that it has appeared in dreams. So, I don't know, but it's a very important question, and I think it's one that at least I want to address in the years I got left. What is the spirit of the depths now? I doubt whether it's the same as it was in Jung's time. There's probably some relationship. And I think it's one of the gifts Jungian psychology can give back.
But it's interesting, one of the really big toys now, with the, especially with the boys, are transformers, which are these little machines. They're trucks or cars or tanks, whatever, but they turn into robots, and then the robots, you know, they fight for good. But the fact is that kids are super comfortable with things not being what they seem, or morphing into something else. And so much so that they actually look for it. So now you see a little boy with a car, he's looking to see if he can turn it into something else.
And wow.
That to me sort of speaks to the spirit of the depths, because I see adults rigidly trying to keep everything the same.
Right.
The children looking to see how they can change it.
Wow.
It's an exciting thing.
That's interesting, yeah.
Well, and the other thing that has really spoken to me about the spirit of the times and the spirit of the depths is, you know, culturally it's one thing, but Jung also talks about how it was affecting him personally.
Right.
Making him go down into where he was caught in that spirit of the times and what the spirit of the depths was asking of him that he was fighting
right.
against. And I think that's just really, I mean, that's part of how I relate to it.
Yeah, I would say if you want to get your money's worth out of this, really ask yourself, where am I being addressed? Mm-hmm. And what response is being asked of me? I'm thinking out loud here, but I'm tempted to say that every piece of psychological suffering ultimately is about the inability to have come up with that response.
To what is being asked of me?
To what's wrong with our time, and what is being asked of me in response. As I am an example of what's wrong with the times. That's what the liberals don't like to deal with. It's all out there.
Ethan, that's ever been a psychological... I missed the first question.
I don't remember what I said.
What is being asked?
Oh, what is being asked of us?
Right, I
have not. Oh, every piece of psychological suffering. Ultimately, I mean, there are many. I sort of think of analysis as pick up sticks. You know, you get this stick off, 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 you get this stick off. You think it'll never end, but really, at the bottom of that stick pile is a challenge to take what you've suffered and respond to it in a way that addresses your version of the public error openly and creatively. To put it in Jung's language, that the collective unconscious, see, this is the collective unconscious, meaning it's a portrait of the forces that are moving a historical epoch. And those forces are problematic, otherwise history wouldn't be a problem. They're also moving me. So part of my healing is ultimately to know the convergence between my suffering and the suffering of the time and address that publicly. Whether it's in a painting or a writing or whatever. I mean, I think everybody's is different. Nietzsche talks about servitude, as we were doing, and I think that's what he's talking about. That really mature living is servitude. It's not serving somebody else, it's serving your own healing, but at the same time, your own healing is a message for the times. And, you know, that's an idea that we'll be seeing in these, in the Red Book, I think, quite clearly, that Jung realizes these dreams about what's wrong with the world are also about what's wrong with him. And it's we are examples of what's wrong with the world. Or we're caught and we're affected by what's wrong with the world. And, you know, you can roll over and play dead. You can get cynical. You can, you know, take flight into materialism. But the creative response is to give an answer.
Well, if we have a
because Kathleen mentioned this last time, we really haven't absorbed the World War One and World War Two.
Right, I don't think we have.
And so that, and you know, we've had a string of wars since.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're still, I mean, to tail on to what Anne was asking, I mean, we're still, in a sense, we're still struggling with, you know, what was the meaning? I mean, this mm-hmm. spirit of darkness
yep.
appeared to Chardin,
right.
and that's the new form of, and so it's, I guess it's kind of, I guess it's kind of an evolution of all those, of the same thing. Maybe
yeah, and maybe going wars. Back and reworking what's been overpowering.
And so to formulate that, what's wrong with our time? Why is there this eruption from the darkness? Is that the same? Is that kind of the same?
Yeah, I think the underlying theme might be fascism. That's what we haven't.
Yeah, and you gave that definition of fascism as being any time one person controls
yeah.
powers over another.
Yeah, and disregards who they are. A lot of fascistic parents out there. But that's why we have dreams of Hitler or Gestapo. They're not uncommon dreams.
So we could say a common theme of what's wrong with this time is the abuse of power.
Yeah.
We saw it in Yahweh and Job.
Yeah.
And we're seeing it in all these different skirmishes and
yeah.
coming along
I think
after
you can.
War.
Yeah.
And so.
And in a way, see, that's the spirit of the times is the power drive. That's why he was going to say, you know, I had to give up my ambition to be a great psychoanalyst. That means I gave up my power. And we'll see, I think it's in here, or at least we'll talk about it. That dream of shooting Siegfried. Siegfried is the Nazi.
And Siegfried is related to Wotan, right?
Yeah.
And that's the power of war that we talk
right.
about in Zarathustra.
Right.
Okay.
So
it seems like this, I mean, that Job experience on an individual level. It played out collectively in the wars.
I think you could say that, yeah. I'd say that's an example of the dark side of God. We're going to be hearing a lot about the dark side of God.
Could I read you a sentence that
yeah.
suit my mind while I was reading this
yeah.
section? Because I'm not sure it makes any sense. I'm not sure I don't think you can
say. Well, join the club.
It says, I put, perhaps our bodies are to the transcendent as shadows are to the light.
That's deep.
It makes us all shadows, doesn't it?
Body to spirit.
Yeah.
Trail to spirit.
See, this is actually on, believe it or not, this is actually on target. So we make it through one sentence this hour. The problem is, from the point of view of the spirit of the depths, where is the transcendent? The transcendent is no longer transcendent, it's immanent. And where is it immanent? In the body. Now, as shadow, as light is to shadow, did you say?
Uh-huh.
I think one of the other implications, which we'll see, and probably I shouldn't dwell on at this point, but that this darkness that we've been talking about actually contains a guidance. So we see everything has been flipped upside down. The body is the spirit, and the darkness is the guidance. Where the spirit was the spirit, and the spirit as guide was experienced in exaltation. Now it's experienced in despair.
And I'm tired to keep going back to children, but I see that they're so much more comfortable with the darkness than than other people are, and it's very intriguing. And my other daughter told me one day, I was trying to explain some of what we do in this class, and she said, oh, you're talking about balance. And I said, how so? And she said, you know, yin yang, push pull, you can't have without the push and without the pull, then you can't have the middle, and you don't stand up. That's why every darkness has some light and every light has some darkness. You know, Mom, yin yang. And I said, where did you learn all of this about yin yang? She said, on TV. I mean,
it's
a cartoon that's aimed at children her age, but that, and to her and to her friends and to the kids I see every day, this idea of darkness,
it's not so strange.
It's not frightening. It just is, and they actually see great value in the darkness. They think it's necessary.
Well, they're right with Jung then.
Yeah, so...
Well, these are the ideas we're going to be seeing in raw form here, and then watch how he took those ideas and kind of systematized them. Turned them into therapy, turned them into theology, and so on. Okay, 2:30. We stop there after the quote, after the italics. And the next paragraph simply repeats what we were saying about the difference between the spirit of the times and the spirit of the depths. That from the point of view of the spirit of the times, being a big shot's the answer. And what conquers that is the spirit of the depths that talks about meaning. Next paragraph, the spirit of the times, spirit of this time tempted me. It's kind of just what you were saying, Tammy, that according to the traditional mindset, darkness is pernicious and to be avoided. And the next one down, the spirit of this time whispered to me. I think the point there is somehow there's a big process going on in the collective unconscious. And the next one in the paragraph, he's saying, and I got to talk about it. But you can see, hopefully, why he couldn't get along with Freud. Everything with Freud is about your personal life. And for Jung, that's certainly true, but it's also true that what is going on in you is a reflection of what's going on underneath the stage of history. At the top of 2:30, he talks about the difference between understanding and explaining. I'm going to try to give that a shot. What's the difference?
Which one are you?
Top of 2:30. The last sentence of the first paragraph, to understand a thing is a bridge and a possibility of returning to the path, but to explain a matter is arbitrary and sometimes even murder.
Seems to me that one says I know and the other says something different. I'm open to looking at something.
So to explain, it's like putting God in a box.
Yeah, it's
God in a box.
It's putting anything in a box.
Right, but to try to understand something means that that question is always open. And so you're always moving towards letting it reveal itself more and more to you.
I put it like this. I think we're saying the same thing. If you explain something, you take what you know to shed light on a particular story. That is your Oedipus complex, or that is your that impulse, that is your mother complex. And if you understand it, you use the story to shed light on you.
What's the story?
Whatever, a dream or a myth or an image.
So one leads to meaning and the other leads to naming, or...
Yeah, it's simply naming.
Okay.
Naming.
One leads to meaning and the other leads to just naming something.
I think that's really true in all of life. You know, people who really understand can really explain, can really go into it, but people who can explain just understand the superficial.
Mm-hmm. So what it does, it gives primacy to the image. I don't tell the image what it means. The image tells me what I mean.
Have you been reading anything about the autistics that are coming out and explaining how their brains work?
No.
They're talking about how people think and how the way they think is broken down so that they see the stages of average human thinking, which is first you get an image, and then that image leads to what we consider normal thoughts. But their thinking stays at the image a lot of times. It's not that they're not intelligent. They are functioning in the world of thought through image.
It's symbolic thinking. Yeah.
And how interesting that phenomenon is more and more prevalent in our
I'm just
children.
Wondering if it has a cultural source. Again, I think here we've got a clear difference between Freud and Jung. I mean, I'm just trying to take these very rich thoughts and give you some sense of where they went. So let's suppose you have a dream of fire. A reductive interpretation would say, well, that's an emotion from something. It puts something that is known as a label on the experience. But it could be, now, I mean, that could be true. I don't mean to say it could never be true, but the other way of looking at things, which I think comes out of this material, is you have an image of fire and you would say, well, I'm in the cooking phase of the alchemical process. So you don't tell that image what it means. That image tells you where you are. And that's one of the distinctions that Jung made with Freud. One labels the image. In another case, the image puts you in its context.
It's also a difference between being rigid and closed and being fluid and open.
I think the danger of the reductive is rigidity, although I do want to stress, I think at times it's valuable. But you've got to be able to do both. And I think the deeper meaning comes when you understand something and you don't try to explain it.
And I also think, go along with Kathleen's, you know, it leaves it open to reinterpretation.
And,
as you evolve and as you, you know, so that Jen was saying, at those different levels, you could reinterpret the image and find new meaning in a later stage in life.
It's the difference between a sign and a symbol. You're aware of that with Jung's 101. A sign says X equals Y. So a church steeple is, Freud would say, symbol. Jung would say, well, it's a sign of a phallus in a dream, say. Where Jung would say, so what's it mean if you dream of a phallus? It's a symbol for creative power. Something that can't be circumscribed rationally, but only expressed in an image form.
What was that thing in, when we were studying this is our last book, Loving Symbol, thank you. And he took it at those different levels. One was, because you had said one is reductive.
Yeah, he did both.
The next one?
Well, you can synthetic, archetypal,
Thank you.
Perspective. He uses a bunch of different words.
In a way, this would also be a way to...
This is the birth of those two methods, the reductive and the synthetic. Another way to put it is, again, now, it's not in this text, but just so you can hear how he developed these ideas, it's the difference between saying that dream image is an unknown expression of something I know but have forgotten, repressed, whatever, versus in the past, versus saying that image is a representation of something that has not yet existed and can exist in the future. Since it hasn't ever existed, you can't say what it is at the moment. All different ways of saying the same thing. But it's a big difference in Jung's and I think most other psychology's understanding of human experience. Listen if you feel they aren't trying to explain things.
That's another use of power, too.
It's power.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolute power.
I understand. I mean, I know you and you don't know yourself.
I know you don't know yourself. And my reality is adequate for defining your reality.
Yes. Okay.
My theory is adequate for defining your reality. And again, I think at times it's right. You just have to know when to use it and when not to use it. I think the more irresponsible the person is, the more likely you are to be right in using the reductive. Okay. Spirit of the time, on the second paragraph on 230, thinks the spirit, talking about the spirit of the depths, is madness. And the next paragraph, but the spirit of the depth stepped up to me and said, what you speak is. So the spirit of the depths would be the imagery which accurately portrays what is actually happening in our time.
Looked at from its point of view.
Looked at from the point of view of the unconscious. Looked at from the point of view of the spirit of the depths, right. And I think a couple of just tangential points. I must speak to the ridiculous. See where I am there?
Mm-hmm.
Supreme meaning combines both opposites. Laughter is worship, laughter and sadness, absurd and true. That's probably obvious by now.
what's obvious.
For most of you, the deeper point of view of the unconscious is interested in the interplay of opposites. And then we'll see why this next paragraph is true, but just to give you an idea of the sobering effect of it, of what we're dealing with here. After this, however, my humanity approached me and said, "What solitude, what coldness of desolation you lay upon me when you speak such. Reflect on the destruction of being and the streams of blood and the terrible sacrifice that the depths demand." Maybe we should look at that. We'll see pretty soon Jung's visions at this time of the war coming. Probably, I don't know if Tammy, you're familiar with those, but around this time he started having nightmares and hallucinations, or I don't know, waking hypnagogic fantasies of Europe being covered in blood and of graveyards, and it shocked him, and he thought he was going crazy. He thought that was a sign of who he was, and what he realized after the war started, no, it was a symbol of what was happening in the times. So I think that's the reference here to the streams of blood. So what he's saying is, you know, I'd really rather not deal with this, but it's in my experience, and I'm paying a price of being alone and cold, separated out from the human community, because I understand things, which now we can see were very accurate, that nobody would have listened to.
Would it have mattered if they had? I mean, you know, if he'd come out as an oracle and everyone said, "Oh, blood all over Europe, we don't want that." I mean, can you stop the spirit of the depths from moving the way that it's going?
I think the spirit of the depths is showing. Well, I see what you're saying. Let me try a different approach. Probably not. In a perfect world, if everyone in Europe had woken up one day and said, "Oh my gosh, we're headed for a war," maybe. But that, of course, is just if pigs could fly, kind of.
People were perfect.
Right. And, you know, I think in a way, the fact that we have avoided a major world war since then is because some of the spirit of the depths has surfaced, and we're realizing we can destroy ourselves.
So does the spirit of the depths, when it reaches the surface, does it then become the spirit of the time?
I think it would become consciousness, which then could motivate people to change what's going on in the time. That makes sense? Again, I think, you know, collectively that's not going to happen. Therapy isn't going to change the course of history. But I think the implication is, if enough people do become conscious, there can be some effect on history. But there's another catch here. The streams of blood from the terrible sacrifice that the depths demand. So there's a couple ways you can look at that. One is to say, oh, that war had to happen. The spirit of the depths demanded it. And I think, to some extent, Jung would agree with that. A entire way of looking at things is in the process of being destroyed. What that is, we'll be following along. And but it is not as pessimistic as it sounds. The point is, a world is insisting on being destroyed. Now, if we can destroy that, just like with recognizing the spirit of the depths, if we can let that be destroyed in ourselves, maybe it won't have to happen outwardly. In other words, we're in a period of value transition. And Jung felt what those wars were the destruction of an old way of valuing. And we still haven't. You know, we get more upset about Bill Clinton's sex life than kids getting blown to pieces in Iraq. And that's classic. That's exactly the kind of thinking that led to World War I and II. Little tea parties where every little detail was mannered. Meanwhile, arms were being built up like crazy. This complete split. I have a cartoon. It's two kids under on either side of a road with big snowball piles, and one says, "We have 6,782 snowballs. You're 6,781, and I hope to God we don't have to use them." That's what was going on in the time when the little tea party was painted. So the destruction is part of the spirit of the depths, but if that can occur inwardly, maybe it won't have to occur outwardly. So if we can not only make the transition to the correct way of seeing, but let die the incorrect, I think that is Jung's gift, hope for change.
Wasn't it true, Gary, that whether it was going to make a difference or not, the spirit of the depths was telling Jung,
yeah,
you have got to do this.
You've got to do
and
it.
And I'm not going to let you
off. Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the beautiful things that it doesn't matter whether it's possible. I've sort of been criticized in talking and things. Like, oh, well, what you're saying is impossible. My response is, I'm not interested in what's possible. I'm interested in what's necessary. And I think Jung is saying our job, if we understand something, is to talk about what is necessary in the shift in our attitudes. Yeah. Jung was no fan of space research. He said exactly that. It's easier to explore the outer world than the inner world.
There's less glory in the inner church.
There's a little less glory, yeah. Let's just do one or two more, and then we'll... actually, this might be a place to stop. What we'll do, I just want to follow up on this idea of the destructiveness in the spirit of the depths, how dangerous that is, and then how Jung felt it doesn't have to be hopeless. Let's have a stretch.